You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Kyle Wood, host of Art Smart and Who Arted. Right now, I'm asking you to help support this show by filling out the network survey at surveymonkey.com/r/airwave. The network is conducting this listener survey to help us improve our shows and find sponsors that you might actually be interested in. As an added bonus, if you take a few minutes to fill out the survey, you'll be entered to win a $500 Amazon gift card as our way of saying thank you. So please help us out and go to surveymonkey.com/r/airwave.
I feel like Who Art Ed.
We're trying to slice it.
Who Art Ed? Mr. Wood Art Ed me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's
off
to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and today we're going to be looking at Pierre-Auguste Renoir. Now, joining me, I have probably the most frequent guest on the podcast, who also happens to be the teacher who got the most shout-outs on the form for my giveaway, although I'm going to send another prize to the runner-up, because I think it never hurts to be a little extra generous. So, Ms. Lamson in North Carolina, if you're listening, check your inbox. Your students appreciate all that you do for them. Now, I'm going to put an end to what has to be my most rambling introduction yet and say, welcome to Chuck Hoff. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. And what that means to my kids, I said, we'll probably get some type of food item in the classroom. There'll be a party. It wasn't a stretch to, like, I will say this, it wasn't a stretch to bribe them, but because they were pretty excited to do the tournament, they'll be excited for round two next week. Especially their former students, they couldn't wait to do this, Arts Madness. So, well, thank you for that.
I think it's funny because I have now so many of my students who have older siblings that are going to your school, and like the younger siblings are now like, do you know Mr. Hoff? He's awesome. Just like, yeah, you got to wait a few more years. But let's get on to our actual topic for today, which is Renoir. Now, it's funny, Renoir, you know, the two of us were talking before we hit record. I think both of us kind of feel the same way. Like, before doing this episode and the research and everything like that, I kind of just lumped him in with, like, Monet and Sicily and, you know, all the great French impressionists. But I didn't really give it much thought, you know? He was one, like, I knew so many of the works but didn't really know him, if that makes sense.
Correct. You know, when you're studying art history in college, let's say, you just lump them up with the style. So the style takes over and the individual artist doesn't really make that distinction. As like maybe Picasso, he kind of transcended cubism. So then you just think Picasso is standing alone. But with the impressionists, they seem to be lumped together in, I think rightfully so, because they kind of hung out together.
Yeah, I mean, as we'll see, they kind of supported each other and built the movement and exhibited together. So it is natural to sort of lump them together in your mind. But, you know, it is a group that was made of individuals. So we're going to learn a little bit more about Renoir today. He was born February 25th, 1841. He was in France. His family moved to Paris in 1845. His father was a tailor. I guess at 13, he was ready to enter the workforce because, you know, childhood didn't really come around until the 20th century. He apprenticed working in a porcelain factory. He was doing stuff like decorating plates with bouquets of flowers and stuff like that. So effectively like painting the glazes onto the porcelain stuff. After that porcelain work, he starts painting fans and cloth banners for churches and all of that sort of just like traditional decorative arts, you know, the applied arts, I guess we would probably call it today. He really enjoyed that type of work, though. So he saved his money to study painting in earnest. In 1862, he began taking courses at École des Beaux-Arts, which, like, I think he's one of the few Impressionists who could actually get in to Beaux-Arts. I feel like most of the others were rejected by Beaux-Arts, just like they were rejected by the Paris salons. That's kind of the reason they stuck together. But during this time, he also studied taking classes like under a Swiss painter, Charles Gleyer. Probably nowhere near right on the pronunciation there, but he was studying in another artist's studio. That was kind of the common practice. Like I said, this was the age of apprenticeships and guilds and stuff like that. It was a pretty rigid kind of formal style, I guess. You know, Gleyer had learned from Ingres, the like neoclassical painter. And Renoir didn't really like the rigid teaching style. I think that kind of shows in his later works. But he was doing it. And he did get along quite well with some other artists who were studying in that same studio. Specifically, Sicily and Monet. So, again, some pretty big names in the Impressionist movement, like the center of that circle was all studying under the same artist. And I guess all kind of hating it, too.
Do we know why they were hating it or no?
I think just like it was very traditional academic. They kind of felt like painting should be out of the studio. It should be directly from nature instead of like this very formal approach. I think it's one of those things that like the 19th century, there was a really big upheaval in society, obviously with the Industrial Revolution. But as I've talked about before, like technology was really changing the arts. We have the obvious, like photography was coming about. And like photography came about middle of the 19th century. So right about this time. And also, the tube of paint. I know the tube of paint doesn't seem like something that has to be invented, but like everything else, it did. The tube of paint came about, I think that was the 1840s as well. I'd have to look it up, but it was like the 1840s, give or take. 1841. That was invented. And so the invention of the tube of paint kind of changed the way that people painted, because before that, part of an artist's training was not just how to apply paint, but literally like the recipes, how to grind up pigments and make their own paints. And like they would store the paints traditionally like in a pig's bladder, which gross, but also really inconvenient to be moving around. You know what I'm saying? Like they would poke a hole in that bladder to like get a little bit of the paint out, and within a matter of days, any paint that was stored in there would dry out. So, like, you can't really carry around a collection of those things out into a field to paint directly from nature. They had to have everything in the studio so they could grind up the pigments and mix them and use them while they're fresh. So when the tube of paint came around, it was like all of a sudden they could take that stuff out into nature. And that's what Renoir, Monet, Sicily, Bezier, again, trying on the pronunciation, I'm sure I'm wrong there, but they moved out to like a forest of Fontainebleau and painted directly from nature, just what they saw.
Can you imagine taking, you know, your your best four or five friends and just having the freedom to go anywhere and set up shop. And so like when our family goes to national parks, so we'll travel to a lot of Western national parks. People will take their summers and sketch the landscapes. So a lot of times we'll ask them like, you know, what are you doing on this rock? And they're like, well, we got an internship to stay here at the national park and sketch and sketch the landscapes. And that's what I feel we draw ourselves back to, is this romantic expression that like all of this, you know, the group started that allowed this freedom. And then they can go out with their friends and really begin understanding color, you know, and how it was placed and get out of the studios. I don't know. That's what I'm drawn to. And I'm sure some people have since been drawn to, as I immediately think of like Ernie Barnes, you know, a podcast that we did together. And I'm thinking, you know, how it is. It's just, we are all naturally drawn to previous artists to allow us the inspiration and give us a little bit of confidence. They blaze the path, right? And yeah, and I could just think of like, what was he thinking? What was Ernie Barnes thinking? Did he go back to Impressionism? You know, did he go back to, you know, post-Impressionism? Did he think like, you know, I want to do this?
Well, I think it's that evolution of styles that we're seeing over time. And in some ways, it seems so simple and just pleasant. It's easy to forget how kind of revolutionary it was, because they were upending everything about the traditional painting methods. They were, in a lot of ways, doing away with the emphasis of line and drawing and focusing just on the color and the value. They were getting outside of the studio. They were really changing where, when, how paintings were being produced. And in a lot of ways, it was fresh and exciting and liberating, but it was also to people who were established artists and established curators and critics, they were like, you're doing it wrong. This isn't what we're used to. We don't like this. This makes us uncomfortable. And so that's why the Impressionists were often rejected by the Paris Salon, and they set up their own shows outside of that structure. And there were some people who loved it. There was one critic who talked about how Renoir's paintings were fresh and invigorating without being bawdy or over the top. And another critic, Albert Wolff, said, if he learned to draw, Renoir would have a very pretty picture. So after the break, we're going to talk about that specific picture he was talking about, Luncheon of the Boating Party from 1881.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
And so now we're back, and we're going to be talking about one of Renoir's most famous, this is largely considered to be one of his masterpieces, The Luncheon of the Boating Party from 1881. So right off the bat, what are you seeing here? What are you noticing?
Light. So with light comes, I do see a triangle as well, where a lady sitting on the, she's kind of leaning on a post, and she's looking into conversations. So to me, I see the emphasis. I see like there's a little bit of an academic attempt to bring the viewer in through the table. Mm-hmm. And to the person with the yellow hat. And there's three of them, three or four yellow hats, which seem to be the more lighthearted, like, you know, they took off their suit, they took off their shirt, they're just kind of like really relaxed. There's wine on the table. I also noticed that each character has a little bit of a glow that I think the artists use as an attempt to brighten up the picture. Because again, you have the shade that should be making this a little bit of a darker setting, you know, taking that some of that natural light away. It appeals to me. And the last thing that I will say, like, initially, is each character, their positioning is done kind of on purpose to give them an equal weight in the painting. So I feel like a couple of the positions are almost unnatural in a way, because they kind of leap into, it's almost like I see like four or five of them doing photo bombs without really knowing it, you know, because they're, you know, I see two or three that are naturally looking away from the painting, but there is a really intentional attempt to like get everybody a little bit of equal attention.
Yeah, I think there's something interesting about the way that all the figures are engaged with each other. You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody is looking at somebody else. Or as I look at where one figure seems to be looking, it leads my eye towards another. You know what I mean? We see the woman who's talking to the dog. We see, as you said, the woman in the straw hat, almost central to the sort of implied triangle of the composition. At the top of that triangle, we see a woman who's facing another man who's facing back at her. You know, we see the man who's leaning over the table and the woman who's turning, looking up at him. We see the guy in the bottom right corner in the straw hat again, sitting Slater style in the chair, backwards in the chair, seems very sort of relaxed, but he's also looking in towards the group. He's looking at the woman who's focused on the dog and the guy who's standing against the railing. Like, it all comes together. And it feels in some ways like a photograph, just a snapshot of this party. But at the same time, we all know when you take a snapshot, you know, there's always somebody who's looking a little wonky, who's looking the wrong way, whose eyes are closed. So he kind of gives it that snapshot feel, but with the light Photoshop, getting everybody to really look their best. As you say, he makes it a little bit brighter. I mean, we do get that hint of shadowing, but it's a brighter version of this, you know, because it needs to work on the canvas. It needs to show their faces. We can't have too dark of shadows, otherwise it's just not so pleasant to look at.
And I understand where the focus and the attention is, but sometimes I drift off, you know, to the corners of the canvas, because I find that like to be where, like, what do you do with the corners? If you know you want 90% of your attention to be on the figures, like, I can only imagine how long it took him to get the hand placed within the dog's fur or, you know, the still life. So here's what I'm thinking. The still life in front of us is like a Cezanne, you know, like influence. Or Cezanne was influenced by this painting, either or. But in the corner, I see Monet's touch. You know, like, I can see him saying, leaning into his friend and saying to Monet, how do I execute that little bit of water and the shadowing and the sailboats? And what do I do to make that less of an emphasis? And you can see these large bushes that cover a beautiful park scene. That I'm not sure. I think there was like artistic freedom. I would love to know if that actual setting there really was blocked. That's what I'm paying money for. I'm sitting at that table and I want to see all of that. And I think there's a little artistic liberty in knowing that I don't want to go to Monet's section and paint all of this. So I'm going to go ahead and brush this really loose bush. that seems to be everywhere, bringing the people closer to us. So I'm fascinated by that because I like to see the little corners of the painting to see what he did and what kind of decisions he made, and maybe how he leaned into a friend or two and just said, what do I do here and what do I do there?
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting point about looking at the corners. I also kind of am in the habit of looking at the edges of works because I feel like it's around the perimeter that you see, like, who's really worked through this. And you know how sometimes, like, you see, like, what looks pretty good in the center of the frame and then, like, it just kind of falls apart at the edges. There's little stuff. The brilliance is in the details. But on the topic of his friends, I don't think we've talked too much about this. He had a habit of painting his friends. So the people in this picture really are his friends. The guy in the bottom right in the straw hat, sleeveless shirt, that's Gustav Caillebotte. Gustav, the guy who painted Rainy Day Paris Street. It's like every art teacher's go-to for an example of two-point perspective. You know the one I'm talking about?
I do, actually, yes.
It's at the Art Institute of Chicago. Massive painting right in the entrance to their Impressionist galleries. Or at least it was back when I was going to school there. But he was not only an impressionistic painter, if I'm being honest, his work doesn't quite feel all that impressionistic to me. He was a little bit more rigid and realistic in his painting style, but he was also a patron of the Impressionists and, like, would put together shows and help support them financially. So he was a really important figure in that movement. And we see him kind of getting that nice, important placement in this composition. He's right in the foreground. The other person who's right in the foreground, the woman sitting with the dog, she was Aline Chérigot. And she was like a seamstress, but also she married Renoir in 1890. The two of them had three sons together. So, like, obviously, she meant something to him. And he's putting her not just in the composition, in the front of the composition. I think there's something nice about the fact that he's focusing on his friends. And that comes through in the tone. Like, this has that warm, positive feel. Like, it's just got good vibes radiating from this. And that's probably partially because of the poses. They seem relaxed. They seem engaged with each other. Like, it seems like a nice group of friends hanging out. But also because of the colors he chose, because he brightened it. He didn't put them in too dark of shadow, even though there's that awning covering them and all of that.
There is one section of drama. So if you look at the straw hat man who's leaning against the railing, mm-hmm, in front of the woman with the dog, he's intentionally looking over to the corner of the painting. And that corner of the painting is the only corner that I felt like he used a different color scheme, one of which was like super bright. And so this bush and this tree has colors that really aren't grouped quite as closely as anywhere else in the painting. So then I'm thinking, of course, you know, he wanted to emphasize like the tree was really close. And of course, that when you're painting, those are pretty intense colors. Then I look at the figures and he's got his arm around the woman who has both hands over her ears. And the guy is consoling her, like both of them, with, again, somebody in the foreground, you know, looking over the party, just wondering what's going on over in that corner. And so that was kind of cool because it was like, I can actually see that happening.
There's always one at every point.
There's always one, like a misunderstanding or whatever. And I wonder if that was intentional. I wonder if he, you know, and again, to the point where you know, I wish he could draw, whatever the criticism was. Look at her hand. I mean, her hand is pretty bent. The fingers are bent in such a way that, like, her thumb is unusually large. And whatever, doesn't really matter, because, you know, we're looking at many other things before we look over in that corner. But it's a pretty cool moment over there in the corner. And so they're just getting to the point of watching and looking at all the corners. I would love to know the story behind it. You know, was it someone in their party of 15 that created drama, or, you know, maybe had a sensitivity to noise or whatever it was? And was he deliberate? And because, you know, nobody's posing like this for 10 hours.
Yeah.
But he was really, he put them in. And if you left them out, I mean, he could have left them out and it still would have been a full picture. But he was really intentional putting those three in.
That's true.
And they're not really as warm as everything else in the picture. That's all.
It's true. But I think, you know, it probably gets back to just the compositional principle of, like, balance. You know, you've got to have the dark to appreciate the light. You've got to have, you know, the people who maybe something went slightly wrong, but they're being consoled and stuff like that. And someone else is, like, checking on their friend, noticing something's wrong. Like, it's a larger scope of emotion there, I suppose you could say, because whenever you bring together a group of people, there's going to be that range of expressions, but they're all in it together, I think, is kind of central to it, that gives it a warmer tone in the final composition. And I think I do feel like I probably want to clarify for people who don't understand why he would get criticism on the drawing for this, because by today's standards, this feels totally fine in terms of the drawing and the draftsmanship. But again, for the day, this was really, really loose compared to what people had been doing. You know, the classic European tradition was try to get it as accurate as possible, and the brushstrokes blended so finely that you could not see it. They were trying for that realism, that naturalism above all else. And here it feels casual because he's not really doing a lot of line work. There's no hard edges defining these figures. It's all just the little dashes of colors that give it this slight soft focus. And in a lot of ways, I think that the softness of the focus makes it feel more positive. It makes it feel nicer. It's what makes it beautiful. But to some people, that just wasn't what they were used to. They wanted something that was more rigid, more strictly defined.
Yeah, and to your point, like, I think junior high has taught me, like, this is the first time kids can really commit, 15, 20, 30 hours a week into a formal schooling, you know, like, not just in our junior high, but they're taking some of these classes outside of the junior high, and they are teaching hyperrealism. You know, I think that generates good business for the teacher because it wows the parents, right?
Yeah.
But it makes a great discussion in the classroom as to, like, murals that you step 15 feet away and that they're really impactful. But if you step too close, if you're, like, right up on it, it won't have the hyperrealism. And so I pit, you know, sometimes we have groups of people who have those two theories and they're converging and they have to work together. And it is pretty fun to watch, you know, just stand back a little bit and they're like arguing, you know, about which is better. I'm like, well, where you want your audience to be standing when you're looking at the painting.
Well, I guess on that topic of arguing which is better, shall we wrap this up?
Yep, you bet.
I'm wrapping it up.
I want
just a 3-point rating scale.
And
where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from?
Or the loop. British for the bathroom.
Yeah, there's a loop joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
I think you savor it. And I don't know if I come out. I may say this every single time I'm on your podcast. So lucky for you, have other people that you invite. But here's why. For me, I'm looking at corners of this painting. I see a few styles and influences of his friends. I know they were out on a limb when they were doing these paintings. We didn't talk about it much, but he had arthritis. And so this would have been someone I looked up to because he was painting, but in such pain. What did he say? Something like, to the point of,
pain passes, but beauty remains.
There it is. And so as a character, I hold him in high esteem, regard. And as a painting, I believe it was the front end of a really awesome movement that allowed some of your urban artists and country artists like Hargrove and to blossom, to like use him as a reference and look back.
Yeah, I think he paved the way for a lot of artists, and I would agree this feels like a museum piece to me. If you had asked me like a month ago, I probably would have said something different. But I think the fact is, like, the more I research and the more I look critically at it, the more I find to appreciate. And with Renoir specifically, the fact that he learned these traditional methods and then loosened up a little bit makes him sort of the perfect transitional figure. And I love the fact that as he's breaking this new ground, as he's exploring, developing these new ways of painting and engaging with the world, he's doing it with his friends. He's focused on the beauty. He's trying to hold up something that just brings joy. And I feel like that is something that needs to be taken seriously. Leisure is often dismissed as frivolous. And, I think it's a fundamental need that people have to build that connection and that positivity in interacting with their friends and their community and those around them. And I see that largely as the emphasis of a lot of Renoir's body of work. Like, he's not just painting a haystack in a field. He's painting these people coming together. And it feels very pro-social to me in a way that I think we need.
And to your point, I think too, when you get a little grouping of artists together, they're having real conversations as to what needs to be ultra or hyper realistic in the painting. Like, I'm in love with the table. It looks awesome. He has the glass.
Little highlights on the glass and everything.
Yeah. Like, I'm like,
I always love that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I do too. And he spent time there. But then he had it. I'm sure he had some conversation as to what do we all do with the background? How do we have it fade? How do we have less emphasis? And how can we keep, or how do we develop this style? How do we stay in this movement? And what do we do to do that?
So. Which feels like a photographic influence in, like, when you think of the depth of field and how things get softer focus as they get farther. You know what I'm saying?
100%. And more so now than ever, right? Our cameras are doing that for us, our iPhones,
Yeah.
So I agree with you.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for being a wonderful friend, always willing to come in and give up a little bit of your free time to join me on the pod. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, you bet.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted, part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you found this tolerable, please leave a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week on social media at Who Arted Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and of course on the website whoartedpodcast.com.
Podcast done.